KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Anti-Semitic bigotry has no place in a civilized society.
President Trump campaigned on a promise to end anti-Semitism, but NPR has identified three White House officials with close ties to anti-Semitic extremists.
It's Wednesday, May 14th, and this is All Things Considered.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Trump administration will end temporary protected status for Afghans this summer.
What will that mean for the thousands of Afghan refugees who may have to return to the country?
There's still a massive humanitarian crisis, and putting people at risk of being returned there definitely exacerbates that situation.
Also, a small network of anti-abortion activists is tapping into traditional definitions of manhood.
And the annual frog jump at the California State Capitol means summer is upon us.
Have a hard conversation with your frog, and hopefully it jumps a little bit further.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump continues his Middle East tour today and says he wants to make a deal with Iran for the country to wind down its disputed nuclear program. However, Trump went on to say in order for there to be any such agreement, Tehran needs to agree to end its support of proxy groups throughout the Mideast.
I want to make a deal with Iran. I want to do something if it's possible. But for that to happen, it must stop sponsoring terror, halt its bloody proxy wars, and permanently and verifiably cease its pursuit of nuclear weapons. They cannot have a nuclear weapon.
Trump is in Qatar and today discussed Iran's nuclear program with Qatar's emir. Trump is in the midst of a three-country visit to the region. The FAA says a hotline between the Pentagon and the air traffic control tower at Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport has not worked since 2022. NPR's Joe Hernandez reports the revelation came after a mid-air collision near the airport killed 67 people. It came to light today during a hearing before the Senate Commerce Committee.
An FAA official confirmed that the hotline between the Pentagon and the airport doesn't work, but that the FAA wasn't aware of that before the January collision. The official said the FAA was insisting it be brought back online before the military resumed flights out of the Pentagon, which were paused after another Black Hawk helicopter got too close to two commercial planes. The FAA says a direct access line was out due to the construction of a new tower at the Pentagon, but that the two facilities coordinate by phone. The Army did not reply to a request for comment. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
A federal judge in Washington has issued a second decision pausing President Trump's executive order ending collective bargaining rights for most federal employees. As NPR's Andrea Hsu explains, the case was brought by a union representing State Department employees.
The American Foreign Service Association had sued President Trump, charging he did not have the authority to end collective bargaining rights for Foreign Service members of the State Department and USAID. The union argued that Trump's executive order was a retaliatory move aimed at unions that have resisted his administration's actions. The White House has said that Trump does have the authority, citing the country's national security interests. The same federal judge issued a nearly identical ruling in a similar case brought by a different union. The government has appealed that decision and is expected to appeal this one, too. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
California Governor Gavin Newsom says his state is facing an estimated $12 billion budget shortfall. Newsom laying out the new number today as he provided details of his proposed nearly $322 billion spending blueprint. Newsom blamed part of the problem on broad economic uncertainties due to Trump administration policies that have affected the stock market. California relies heavily on revenue from tax on capital gains. A mixed close on Wall Street today. The Dow was down 89 points. You're listening to NPR. Some major orders for airplane builder Boeing have been one offshoot of President Trump's Mideast visit this week, a day after news of an order from a company in Saudi Arabia for 20 of the company's 737-8 jets with options for more. Qatar has placed a big buy of its own. The Qatari deal, valued at $96 billion, is for Boeing's 787 and 777 widebody jets. It's being described as the biggest order of its kind in Boeing's history. China this week also lifted a ban on its airplanes taking or airlines taking delivery of Boeing planes. Cassie Ventura, a centerpiece of the federal case against Sean Combs, finished her second day of testimony today. Ventura described at the court how she finally ended her relationship with the rapper. And just a note, this report mentions physical and sexual assault. Here's NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento.
Cassie Ventura spent hours testifying about the violence, blackmail, and isolation she experienced during her more than 10 years dating Combs. Prosecutors showed multiple photos of Ventura's bruises and injuries from what she said were beatings by Combs. Ventura also testified that Combs raped her in 2018 after she ended the relationship. In tears, she told the court she decided to speak out about the abuse years after the breakup because she was tired of carrying the shame. The defense concedes that Combs was violent and abusive, but says that doesn't make him guilty of sex trafficking and racketeering. Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices eased a bit today. Oil down 52 cents a barrel to $63.15 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump campaigned on a pledge to fight anti-Semitism.
Anti-Semitic bigotry has no place in a civilized society. It has no place in our universities, and it has no place in the United States of America. No place.
But critics of the president question whether anti-Semitism does have a place in the White House. NPR has identified three different administration officials with ties to anti-Semitic extremists. NPR investigative correspondent Tom Dreisbach reports, and a warning, this story includes offensive language.
Last summer, the Holocaust denier and white nationalist Nick Fuentes held a rally on a street in Detroit.
I don't know about you, but calling Donald Trump a racist only makes me like him more.
Yeah! Amanda Moore was watching that rally. She's a freelance journalist who's reported on the far right for years, and she started scanning the crowd.
I recognize some of the people that I've been covering in the past. One was Paul Ingracia.
At the time, Paul Ingracia was a young lawyer and pro-Trump activist.
I've seen him at other events. I'm familiar with his social media, so he was hard to miss.
A few weeks later, Moore sent Ingracia a direct message on social media and asked about the rally. Ingracia wrote back, basically pleading ignorance. He said he'd only walked past there for maybe 5 minutes out of curiosity. And as soon as he figured out what the rally was, he left. Did you find Paul Ingracia's response to you credible?
No, not at all.
For one thing, Moore was recording, and based on her footage, which she shared with us, she estimates he was there for closer to 20 minutes, not five. And there's another live stream video showing Ingracia smiling as he walked right up to Fuentes before his speech. Plus, Ingracia had posted online about how dissident voices like Nick Fuentes should have a place in conservative politics.
So I responded with the videos and the timestamps that I had, and I asked if he could clarify his position, and he blocked me.
About 6 months later, Paul Ingracia joined the Trump administration. He is now the White House liaison to the Department of Homeland Security, and that is not his only link to an anti-Semitic extremist. Last year, Ingracia spoke at a fundraiser for January 6th defendants. He said January 6th was a dark day, but not because it was an insurrection.
But rather, it was an opportunity for the deep state to finally remove its mask and begin prosecuting and jailing innocent American citizens like Tim.
The Tim Ingracia is referencing there is a rioter from New Jersey named Timothy Hale Cusinelli. Federal prosecutors said he was a Nazi sympathizer who said Hitler should have finished the job. Hale Cusinelli denies that. He calls himself a satirist, though he also went to work with a Hitler mustache and recorded a long rant blaming Orthodox Jews for the spread of COVID-19.
New Jersey will recover from the coronavirus, but it will not recover from the Hasidic Jewish invasion.
Hale Cusinelli and Ingracia appeared at multiple events together last year. Now, in response to NPR's questions, Ingrassia said he denounces Hale Cousinelli's anti-Semitic rhetoric. He also said he was at the Fuentes event for 5 to 10 minutes and said his advocacy for, quote, certain individuals is about a commitment to the First Amendment and due process, not an endorsement. Meanwhile, Hale Cousinelli also appeared at several events with another Trump official, Ed Martin, who works at the Justice Department. Last summer, Martin called Hale Cousinelli a great friend, an amazing man, and gave him an award.
It's one of the goals of many of us to make sure that the world, and especially America, hears more from Tim Hale.
Martin later claimed he did not know about the anti-Semitic comments and said he regretted giving him an award and apologized. Rachel Colley has not publicly apologized for her ties to Hale Cousinelli. She's currently the communications director for the White House Office of Management and Budget. For years, she advocated for Capitol riot defendants.
We're seeing with our own two eyes, America seeing the video footage of just how wrong and how disingenuous this whole witch hunt has been, not only for the political prisoners, but President Trump and all the defendants.
Colley attended part of Hale Cousinelli's Capitol riot trial and sat with his supporters. She called it a, quote, clown trial. She was also a board member and handled media requests for a nonprofit that advocated for January 6th defendants. Back in 2022, the leader of that nonprofit, the Patriot Freedom Project, gave a lengthy interview to an explicitly white nationalist website, a site that has a whole section on Hitler's significance for our struggle. That interview was taken down after it got wider attention online. When I called Rachel Colley for comment, she told me three times, send me an email. She did not respond to my emails.
Look, at this point, it's clear that these are not isolated cases.
That's Amy Spitalnik. She's the CEO of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs. And she says the administration is using anti-Semitism as a pretext to cut funding to universities and deport pro-Palestinian protesters.
The ways in which the administration is exploiting the Jewish community's legitimate fears and concerns about anti-Semitism is ultimately undermining Jewish safety.
The White House did not respond to messages seeking comment for this story. Spitalnik says if the White House were serious about fighting anti-Semitism, they could start by not hiring people with ties to extremists. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
There's the Idaho potato, the Florida orange, but what about the Wisconsin ginseng? The state produces about 90% of this country's ginseng. The prized root is then sent across the world for people to eat or drink or turn into ointments. And the epicenter of American ginseng cultivation is a little town called Marathon, Wisconsin. Cartoonist Craig Thompson knows this because he grew up there. Thompson's the author of the award-winning graphic novel Blankets, and he's got a new book out called Ginseng Roots, tracing the history and his ties to the plant. Andrew Limbong, host of NPR's Book of the Day podcast, picks up the story.
Back in 2011, cartoonist Craig Thompson fell. He was in China.
I was in Yangshua doing this very touristy thing, riding a bamboo raft on the Yulong River, you know, very picturesque. And I was helping the boatman carry our little raft over these small rapids. I slipped and fell on my drawing hand. I thought I sprained it.
Someone helped him get to a pharmacy on the outskirts of town.
And it got me this spray that instantly took away the pain and the inflammation. And the primary ingredient was ginseng. I look around this pharmacy and there's ginseng everywhere, including Wisconsin ginseng.
There's an irony at the core of the global ginseng trade. See, there are two types of ginseng. There's Asian ginseng and American ginseng.
Asian ginseng is the one we probably are most familiar with from like truck stops and stuff, this like stimulating herb that's going to power you through like coffee.
This is what's more popular here in America. However,
American ginseng is a more cool adaptogenic herb that you can use to nourish your general health. You can take it daily. For that reason, it's more prized in China.
Thompson says America's history exporting ginseng to China goes back to 1784, when we needed money to pay back our debts to France for helping fund the American Revolution.
So maybe there's no USA without ginseng. There's certainly, it was the beginning of this trade relationship that's becoming more and more forefront and crucial.
Thompson grew up on ginseng farms. His new graphic novel, Ginseng Roots, opens with him as a boy, waking up before dawn, putting on shoes still damp from yesterday's work, and heading out into the fields to pull weeds and pick up rocks, roots, and berries.
And I was just happy to do the work, really. We were a working class family. I always say that my parents provided us what we needed, but none of the things we wanted. So if we wanted expendable income for toys and candy, or in my case, comic books, we had to earn that money ourselves.
The book is part memoir, part reporting on how the ginseng trade connects Thompson's life to so many others. Farmers and business owners in America, he goes to South Korea and talks to wholesale vendors. In China, Thompson visits markets and interviews shop owners. It's an intricate web of growers, producers, and consumers.
One of my favorite lines in the book is given by your acupuncturist, who says something along the lines of, like the difference between a weed and an herb is that a weed doesn't have a narrative, right? A storyline, whereas an herb does.
Yeah, the acupuncturist is Justin Penoyer. I did a lot of interviews with him. I didn't know where they fit in the book until late in the process of the book, where I started working with him as a patient because of my own health issues.
Remember how he fell on his drawing hand?
But that line from Justin is so profound. A weed is a plant that's lost its social narrative really resonated with me. I think it resonates with a lot of people and where they feel like they are in the world.
When Thompson draws himself, his face is more minimalist, for lack of a better term, more cartoony. The people he talks to, though, people who found a narrative for their lives in ginseng, he draws their faces with weight and detail.
How's your hand now?
It's not great. I have a genetic condition that's degenerative. I've tried everything. It seems like that.
You can probably guess which herb has helped Thompson the most.
I work slower than I used to, but that could also be a result of age. You know, I turned 50 this year. So every cartoonist I know says you can't keep up the pace you had when you were in your 20s, when you were drawing around the clock and wearing your body into the ground.
Has it changed the way you think about the longevity of your career? Like, do you have X amount of more projects in you?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. During the course of this book, I thought this was the final. I thought this was my swan song to comics. Amazingly, coming out on the other side, I do feel like I will make more books. Maybe it's just what I'm best suited towards.
People make things. That's an obvious point, but it's also easy to forget. The things we consume, someone, somewhere touched it. They gave it a narrative. They turned it from a weed into an herb. And so you're connected to that person in whatever small way. That's true of the tea you drank this morning, to the cream you'll put on your face tonight, to the book you hold in your hands. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Is it possible to have a childhood that is both picture perfect and perfectly awful? And if so, how much of the baggage will you end up carrying 20 plus years later when you have children of your own? Honor Jones explores these questions in a quietly, profoundly beautiful new novel titled Sleep. Honor Jones, hi.
Hi.
Hi. I'm going to let you take the lead here on how much to give away of the secrets in your protagonist Margaret's past. So you paint us a picture of how I just described it, this picture perfect but also perfectly awful childhood. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so she grows up, she has this kind of wonderful best friend who also follows her through life. And, you know, she has a family and a brother, and she's growing up in sort of this verdant suburban world. But something happens that's really disorienting, and she isn't protected. So she sort of has to grow up protecting herself. And she's very watchful and, like, perceptive as a child, but I think becomes more so for practical reasons. So she turns into, as a mother, someone very concerned with the question of how you raise children to be safe without raising them to be afraid, and like what the right level of vigilance is, which is, I think, something that all parents worry about.
Yeah. All right. You said something happened and she is not protected. So I have to ask you about, to me, the other central character in this novel, which is the mother, Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Describe Elizabeth.
Well, she's incredibly charismatic. She sort of does have this magic about her, and her daughter, like, never stops being obsessed with her, and she's larger than life. She's also very domineering, and
She's mean, just to state it and plainly. She's really mean. She's cruel. Yeah,
you're right. It's so funny that I didn't, like, lead with that. She can be really cruel, and she has these expectations of the way that she wants everyone around her to be.
Yeah. To what extent does that inform how Margaret raises her own daughters, the granddaughters in this family?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of this, she has her mother in the back of her head, I think, as all of us do when, you know, the kid wants candy and you're like, yes or no, what would my own mother do? How can I do the opposite of that thing? And then you make the wrong decision, you know. So she's raising children in the city and she's divorced and, you know, it's not the picture perfect life, but it is really fun in a lot of ways. And there's an openness and freedom to it. But she's always second-guessing herself.
There's a scene that shot me through with recognition. I'm going to let you read it to me. But just to set us up, this is Margaret, grown-up Margaret. She and her girls are walking to school. And one of the girls spots, because again, they're in New York City, spots a dead rat in the gutter. And of course, this is the greatest thing ever. She wants to go investigate. And Margaret, the mom, yanks her so hard. She fears she has dislocated her daughter's shoulder. Would you read us just those few lines, starting with, I want to see.
I want to see, Joe said again and tried to twist away, but Margaret held onto her hand. And for a moment, they both pulled in opposite directions until Joe cried out and clutched her arm. Oh, God, she dislocated her elbow again. No, how could she let this? What kind of mother? Never mind. It was fine. It was totally fine. Joe's arm was moving normally by her side. In Margaret's relief, she no longer minded about the rat. So much of parenting was this, the instantaneous lowering of expectations. Her children were safe. Nothing else mattered.
I know that feeling so well. The instantaneous lowering of expectations. It's exactly what parenting is. I, as a mother myself, you start out so many days, you have these highbrow aspirations. You're going to go to the museum. You're going to do something educational. You're going to have this nutritious, leafy, green extravaganza for dinner. And by the end of the day, you're like, nope, it's chicken nuggets and Cartoon Network.
Yeah.
And it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, you're constantly checking like what actually matters and being sort of put in your place about your aspirations.
Yeah. So your writing, I called your novel beautiful, and it is. The writing is very spare, even when, maybe especially when you are describing vast, overwhelming emotion. Mm. Do you start Honor Jones with a more flowery sentence and prune it back, or how does it work?
I don't. Actually, I don't know if this is like the editor in me, but I start incredibly condensed and then I have to add. So I wrote things very tightly and then I thought, oh, this there's more to say here, or this can breathe more, and then it would get longer, and then of course you edit yourself back down again to something. But I did edit some things out. I think I described like light playing on a surface like 300 times in a draft. And I did have to go through and search for the word light and then take a bunch out.
Be like, enough. It has refracted, enough, refracted, reflected, shimmered, and we're moving.
It's done all I can do.
Honor Jones, talking about her debut novel, Sleep. Honor Jones, thank you so much.
Thank you.
California lawmakers have spent the day dealing with a grim budget situation. But before that task, politicians, their staff, and the press found a few moments of joy as they competed in a riveting contest. The annual frog jump on the lawn of the California Capitol. Cap Radio's Megan Myskowski was there.
A crowd in suits and dresses gathers around a roped-off area on the Capitol grounds.
All right, next we have representatives from the California Treasurer's Office. Geraldine. Let's hear it for Geraldine.
Catherine Weir Ebster is the representative, and Geraldine is her frog. Some of the other frog contestants at the jump today? Frogs in My Backyard, Hoppenheimer, and Amphibiance. Weir Ebster puts Geraldine down and claps to scare her into jumping away.
Oh, he's looking.
That's the whole point of frog jumping, which Weir Ebster says is in her genes. Her mom did this in the 60s.
Because I grew up in the foothills, I kind of just have known about the frog jump my whole life. So it's just one of those things, you just don't touch the frog for too long.
You wouldn't want it to get too comfortable.
And you want to basically get in its natural instincts to get away.
Frog jumping has roots in a Mark Twain short story called The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, which made Twain and the tradition famous. Calaveras County, a hop southeast of Sacramento, has held a frog jumping event since the 1920s, where people try to get frogs to go as far as they can in just three jumps. State Senator Marie Alvarado Gill represents the region in the legislature and hosts the event. She made the leap from the Democratic Party to the Republican last year. She's no longer in the majority in the legislature, but she totally is at the frog jump. There are a few more Republicans competing than Democrats. Republican lawmaker David Tongipah also represents the area and told me the best way to get a frog moving is to yell at it. A piece of advice that works a little less well inside the Capitol.
Have a hard conversation with your frog and hopefully it jumps a little bit further.
Soon it was my turn and I took that advice. I got a frog, I gave it some words of encouragement, then a little yelling, slapped the ground, and I won.
The longest jump and the winner in our media category was Megan with Green Machine at 14.3.
For NPR News, I'm Megan Myskowski in Sacramento.
It's NPR News.
The Supreme Court will hear arguments in a case challenging the constitutional provision that guarantees citizenship to everyone born in the United States.
Citizenship under the 14th Amendment needs to apply in a way that is uniform across the country.
The dispute over birthright citizenship on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. New Orleans is known as the birthplace of jazz.
But to make sure the city holds on to that legacy, one organization is helping kids learn all about the genre.
I'm surprised that I saw all of the instruments that I thought that I would never see.
That story and more after these news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The federal courts are asking Congress for nearly $900 million to protect federal judges and their families. NPR's Kerry Johnson has more on testimony today from judges at a House Appropriations hearing.
Judge Amy St. Eve says the threat environment against judges is complex and evolving. She's asking Congress to provide enough funding this year to harden federal courthouses and shore up security for judges online and in their homes. The courts have been operating under a budget freeze, even as federal judges have endured serious threats of violence in recent years. Separately, some Republican lawmakers have proposed impeachment for judges who rule against the Trump administration. Judge Robert Conrad told House lawmakers threats of reprisal and retribution against judges simply for doing their jobs erode the rule of law. Kerry Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Federal rules to reduce the levels of forever chemicals in drinking water being delayed. NPR's Ping Wong reports the Environmental Protection Agency is reconsidering them.
PFAS are a class of chemicals that have been used for decades to waterproof and stain-proof products. They've been linked to certain cancers and damage to the liver and immune system. Last April, the Biden administration set limits on the amount of PFAS chemicals allowed in drinking water, requiring community water systems to start installing filters to remove them. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin announced that the agency is delaying the compliance timeline for some chemicals and reconsidering the allowable levels for others.
But that doesn't mean that it gets weaker. The number might end up getting lower, not higher.
Health advocates worry that the move will delay the removal of these chemicals from drinking water and that more people will be exposed to chemicals that can contribute to chronic health problems. Ping Huang, NPR News.
Stocks finished mixed on Wall Street today. This is NPR. Some San Franciscans went in search of a chest containing about $10,000 worth of buried treasure yesterday. NPR's Chloe Veltman says the hunt was prompted by an anonymous post sharing cryptic messages on Reddit.
The clues led a lot of people on Reddit to Sutro Baths, a historic swimming pool complex by the Pacific Ocean. Eamon McLaughlin went there with his friend. He read out the clues.
18 bold letters preserved in a clearing cite a dark room's view of brave surfers reeling. From dry ruins gate.
His group didn't find the treasure, but another group did. Austin Terrio, TJ Lee, and Eric Bari say they located the chest after just over an hour of searching. It contained a big gold nugget in a corked bottle with sand in it, a Panama Pacific Exposition bronze coin, and three collectible Barry Bonds baseball cards, among other finds. All of it buried under a bush near a hiking trail intersection, more than 5 miles away from Sutro Baths. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Well, the oldest known fossil footprint of a reptile-like animal was recovered by scientists near Melbourne, Australia. Researchers there say the fossil, discovered on a slab of sandstone, dates to around 350 million years ago. Scientists say the discovery suggests the first animals emerged from the ocean and had long toes and hooked claws that may have looked similar to a monitor lizard found in Africa and Asia. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. On Monday, the Trump administration welcomed the first plane load of white South African refugees into the U.S. Also on Monday, it announced it will end the Temporary Protected Status Program, or TPS, for Afghanistan this summer. That means more than 9,000 Afghan refugees may soon be forced back to the country now ruled by the Taliban. Joining me now is Murari Zafar, adjunct associate professor at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University. Welcome.
Thank you.
So Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said that conditions in Afghanistan have improved sufficiently enough to warrant terminating TPS. But I just want to point out, the State Department lists the travel advisory for Afghanistan as the highest risk and warns American citizens, do not travel. So in your mind, what is the state of security in Afghanistan right now?
Yeah, the statement is, it seems a little bit misleading because putting it in the context of Afghanistan has a level 4 security advisory. Mm-hmm. South Africa, from which we recently received refugees, I think on Monday, has a level 2 advisory, which is on par with Sweden and Italy. It calls into question what are the benchmarks against which Afghanistan is being assessed in this regard.
Right.
One of the things that the statement ignores is the fact that the absence of war or large-scale conflict doesn't mean there's safety. There's still a massive humanitarian crisis, and putting people at risk of being returned there definitely exacerbates that situation.
So in real-world terms, what will sending some of these people back to Afghanistan mean for their personal safety and well-being?
You know, a lot of people here have, they've been working, living and working in the U.S. for anything from 2 to 4 years now. If they didn't even previously work with the U.S. administration, they're still marked as having lived in America. There's also that consideration that there are local populations who have started to bear resentment towards those who got out. Mm-hmm. As an anthropologist that has studied post-conflict societies, that happens frequently. So it's creating this ripe condition for further conflict once these communities are returned.
What are you hearing from people reaching out to you for help right now?
I think there's just a lot of confusion right now. People don't really know where to go. They've effectively got until now and July 12th to come up with a plan. And a lot of that requires reaching out and getting a new immigration status. But that puts the burden on a lot of the immigration attorneys, and they're already, they've got overflowing cases and they can't handle everything. So 2 months is not remotely going to be sufficient time to be able to deal with these cases adequately. Yeah. So I think the only thing that can really assist these communities is for Congress to step in and at least require some form of extended cover for them until the cases can be repealed and reassessed.
Well, you mentioned Congress. American veterans who served in the war in Afghanistan, including Republicans, are among the strongest advocates for protecting Afghan refugees in the U.S., especially those who helped the U.S. in its war effort. So do you have any hope that they or others can get Congress to take up this issue?
I do. I think there's such an important and salient community in this effort because I think they understand what the ripple effects of these policies are on a national security perspective. But by injecting these communities back into Afghanistan, you're creating vulnerable populations that are then susceptible to recruitment by extremist groups. And ISIS is active and operating in Afghanistan. We already know this. So I think they understand the threat that this could pose to the U.S. in the long term, fight that we may have to fight another time. So I think that they would be more successful than other communities in pushing for it.
Murari Zafar, adjunct associate professor at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
New Orleans is known as the birthplace of jazz. Take a walk through the French Quarter and you'll likely hear a band playing. But how do the culture bearers there keep the genre alive? Matt Bloom with member station WWNO visited an iconic venue that introduces kids to the beat.
Inside a 60-seat theater just off of Bourbon Street, a jazz band grooves for an audience of excited second graders on a field trip. This place is called Preservation Hall. It's one of the oldest jazz venues in the Big Easy, and increasingly, it's a place for kids to learn about the tradition directly from artists.
All right, now, you guys, does anybody have any questions for the band?
In a break from the music, trumpet player Brandon Lewis lifts a metal mute out from a crate.
Anybody know what this is?
No!
What if I put it like this?
The venue opened in the 60s and welcomed a few kids back then. Since then, it's grown into a formal program called Kids in the Hall. It hosts over 8,000 students a year from schools in Louisiana and across the country to learn about New Orleans jazz. Band members encourage students to get up and dance and sing along. For many, it's their first time learning about jazz.
I usually listen to like pop and country music.
8-year-old Micah Venable says this is her first big jazz show, and now she wants to hear more.
I like all of the things that they sang and stuff, and I'm surprised that I saw all of the instruments that I thought that I would never see.
That sense of wonder is exactly what leaders here want. Wendell Brunius is the hall's musical director and a lifelong jazz musician.
To keep the music going, perpetuate the music, you have to give it to the young people. They're the future.
Brunius, who's 79, grew up coming to play at Preservation Hall with his father in the 70s, learning from local legends like clarinetist George Lewis. He wants other kids to have the same experience.
To really realize that they've been entertained rather than either taught a lesson or, you know, just spewed some stuff, just that they've been entertained and that they feel happy. That's very important to us.
Soon, even more students can take part in the tradition of making jazz. The Hall's foundation recently leased a 3-story building next door. They plan to renovate it into more rehearsal spaces, artist apartments, and an archive of local jazz history. Back in the theater, that tradition of music is on full display. This time, it's a group of young adults with special needs. One of the students, Andrew Hennington, gets up to play trumpet alongside the band. Hennington is 25 and has autism. He started taking lessons from the musicians at Preservation Hall as a teenager. Now he plays with them in parades and festivals all around the city.
I like some of the music. Makes me feel good.
His mother, Susan, who's with him today, says it's been life-changing.
We'll walk through the quarter and there are people that I don't know that are saying hello to Andrew because they've seen him in here. I think he'll have a good future, you know, ahead of him and be something that'll bring him pleasure.
She says her family owes a lot to Preservation Hall, and her son Andrew is fulfilling the promise of its founders to keep jazz alive in the city. For NPR News, I'm Matt Bloom in New Orleans.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments tomorrow on the Trump administration's push to end birthright citizenship. A majority of Americans oppose that plan. That's according to a new NPR Ipsos poll, even as other parts of the White House's immigration crackdown draw wider support. NPR's Joel Rose has been looking into the findings and joins us now to explain. Hi.
Hi.
So, Joel, just start by telling us, what does the poll say about what Americans think of President Trump's hardline immigration policies so far?
Sure. Trump's crackdown has gone in some ways well beyond what any previous administration has tried. For example, his push to quickly deport alleged gang members without giving them a chance to contest those allegations in court under a seldom used wartime law from the 18th century called the Alien Enemies Act. Almost half of respondents in our poll say they are in favor of that. I talked to Randy Crabtree. He's a Republican from Vermilion, Ohio.
I agree with what he's trying to do. Removing those that are gang affiliated and sending them to the prison down there in El Salvador, I wholeheartedly applaud.
But some of Trump's other proposals have less support. For example, birthright citizenship, the long-standing practice of granting citizenship to any child born on U.S. soil, regardless of their parents' legal status. Most legal scholars say that is guaranteed by the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Trump, though, is pushing to end it, and our polling shows that 53% of respondents oppose that. And the poll shows that even Republicans are split on it.
Got it. Okay, well, so does this poll show any big shifts on immigration since President Trump took office?
Not really. It is actually remarkable how stable people's attitudes have been about these hardline immigration policies. But we are seeing perhaps some softening of support, particularly around President Trump's push for mass deportation of everyone who is in the country without legal status. I talked to one poll respondent named Crystal Thomas from Louisville, Kentucky. She considers herself a Republican-leaning independent. And she did vote for Trump, but she told me she has been concerned that this has gone a little too far, as she hears stories about immigrants who've lived and worked in her community for years, not hardened criminals and gang members, being swept up in the Trump administration's crackdown.
It's too much. They're just doing this stuff, I think, to pump up numbers. Like, oh, hey, we got this many people out of the country, and everyone's just cheering them on. Like, oh, wow, you guys are doing such a good job. But, like, at the end of the day, these are real people, and these are real families that they're ripping apart.
3 months ago, about 44% of people we polled supported Trump's mass deportation plan. In this poll, that number had dropped to 40%.
Joel, as you and others have been reporting, the Trump administration has pushed to limit the due process rights for immigrants who are in the country illegally. Does the poll have anything to say about that?
There is actually a lot of support for the president's position here. Almost half of respondents agreed with President Trump that it would take too long to give trials to millions of immigrants without legal status before deporting them. But some were dismayed by what they see as an erosion of fundamental constitutional rights. I talked to Catherine Welty, a Democratic voter who lives near Phoenix, Arizona, and she's troubled that scores of Venezuelans and others were quickly deported without a chance to fight the allegations in court that they are gang members.
It's shocking that that would happen without any sort of due process. And if mistakes are happening and they're doubling down and they're like, well, that's too bad for them kind of thing. And it's very scary. That's not the way I thought America worked.
Welty describes herself as multiracial, and she worries that her 20-year-old son could be mistaken for an immigrant without legal status.
That is NPR's Joel Rose. Thank you, Joel.
You're welcome.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. A small network of anti-abortion rights activists has been making surprising progress advancing an unpopular agenda in state houses. They're pushing for bills that would classify people who get abortions as criminals. And they're trying to build support by leaning into the heightened national discussion right now about what manhood should be. NPR domestic extremism correspondent Odette Youssef reports.
Outside a women's health clinic in Greenville, South Carolina, dozens of anti-abortion rights activists waved signs at passing cars. They were in town for a regional anti-abortion conference. Some held signs about abortion, but many carried a different message. Quote, what is a man? Provider, protector, spiritual leader.
Every abortion involves a man, right?
Jason Storms is National Director of Operation Save America.
I would argue probably the majority of abortions involve a selfish and irresponsible man who's failing to properly love the woman in his life.
Storms' movement sees its anti-abortion work as tightly bound with another campaign to promote a traditional and nostalgic interpretation of what manhood should be. Storms calls it biblical manhood.
What does godly biblical manhood look like contrasted with what our world is presenting to young men? On one side, sort of a weak passive, on the other side, sort of the overcompensated, you know, gangster rapper, or the, you know, both are faulty images of masculinity.
Storms says Christian men should be chivalrous and like knights in shining armor. But he also emphasizes another characteristic in sermons he has given.
Our text in Ecclesiastes says there's a time for war. There is even a time to kill. There's a time to fight. There's a time for Christian men to engage in physical conflict.
Storm says Christian men have a duty to
get an AR-15, get a combat weapon, to get some other combat gear.
He says they should form tactical units and train. He said he started doing this with men in his church during the pandemic. This idea that men need to be a certain way is paired with an inflexible notion of how women should be. And when those ideals are met, there's a belief that abortion will largely go away. Many who are pushing hardline policies against abortion frame them not as instruments of punishment or female oppression, but as a spur to establish godly order in America. But Dana Sussman says the reality is that restrictive abortion policies do not produce benevolent patriarchy. Instead, they put pregnant women in danger.
That is the most vulnerable time for them to be victims of violence, including homicide.
Sussman is with Pregnancy Justice, a legal advocacy organization for pregnant people.
And when people can't obtain abortions or have to do so surreptitiously, they are connected to their partners or their ex-partners in ways that might be really dangerous to them.
And the dynamics within this extreme faction of the anti-abortion rights movement can be telling.
It is heavily male-led.
For a few years, Caroline Hodges was involved with a group of extreme anti-abortion activists in Michigan. She ended up getting arrested with several of them in 2022.
Being arrested by the FBI was the best thing that's ever happened to me, ever.
Hodges now describes the group she was with as a cult. And she says it was part of a national network that was basically, quote, a bunch of dudes.
It's like in Operation Save America, you have like a handful of men that everybody looks up to. But then there's like this man looks up to this man, and this man looks up to this man, and this man looks, and then you have this web of people who have people underneath them all over the country.
Hodges says it was sometimes shocking to see how women were treated. She recalled a male pastor who yelled at her in front of a group for having spoken in the presence of men.
I haven't spoken to my mom in 3 years, but at the time, I called her in tears because of the way that I was being treated for being a woman.
Oh, that's exactly right. We are teaching our children to expose
go
evil.
Out and harass businesses and just yes. Stand out.
In Greenville, some of the anti-abortion activists moved on from the clinic protest that morning. Their next target, a catering business. They were calling out an employee who is supportive of abortion rights. But some friends of the business also showed up to distract and disrupt them. And on that tight patch of sidewalk, tensions flare between those friends of the business and the teenage boys who are being raised in these anti-abortion circles.
Dude, you're in the way. Say excuse me. Say excuse me. I'm a lady. Treat me like a lady.
You don't look like one.
You're a female.
That's a woman.
I'm a lady.
They're empowered to do that. They're raised to do that. Their fathers are proud of them doing that.
Hannah McSherry is a Greenville native who says she will help any woman who needs an abortion to get one. She says the teenage boys she encounters on the protest line aren't embodiments of chivalrous, respectful, Christ-like men, but she says she feels compassion for them because the lack of nuance they're being taught about gender ends up not preparing them for what they see in real life. In her case, that looks like women who speak up, speak over men, and support other women.
I'm also a tall drink of water, you know, and a woman of size, and they are threatened by me.
The panic over the state of manhood in America seems to have reached into every corner. It was the topic of a documentary by Tucker Carlson.
The decline of manhood, of virility, of physical health, all of which together threaten to doom our civilization.
To powerful tech heads like Mark Zuckerberg.
I do think a lot of our society has become very, like, I don't know, I don't even know the right word for it, but it's like kind of like neutered or like emasculated.
To Congressman Glenn Grothman on the House floor, saying men have been robbed of their purpose and casting blame.
In the 1960s, in addition to the Marxists, we had the angry feminist movement.
I asked Jason Storms why, on social media, he follows Andrew Tate, a misogynist who's been charged with rape and human trafficking of women.
Yeah, well, he's a cultural influencer. He influences millions of particularly young men.
Storms says if Tate is guilty of the crimes he's been charged with, he should be executed.
That being said, Andrew Tate, there's a lot of truth in some of the things that he says. One of the big ideas that he has is that men in this culture have been weakened and made effeminate.
Storm says whether it's him or Tate, a message is resonating with young men who are looking for something that provides them purpose and strength and meaning. Odette Youssef, NPR News.
This story was made possible in part by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Mathnasium. Whether students are ahead of the curve or need extra support, Mathnasium's goal is to build confidence through personalized math instruction. Learn more at mathnasium.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law.